Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and this week on What Matters in North Carolina, we are going to listen into an interview between Susan Myrick, Elections Policy Analyst for the Civitas Institute, and Hans von Spakovsky with the Heritage Foundation, who is also an elections guru in his own right. They will talk to us about what's going on with elections in the state, especially in the courts in North Carolina, where we cannot seem to keep our districts and other things regarding elections out of the court system. Next up, we'll talk with George Landreth, who is the president of Frontiers of Freedom, about what they have going on at their organization. Then we'll move on to Governor Pat McCrory, or former Governor Pat McCrory, and he will talk about what he has been up to since losing his election to now Governor Roy Cooper, and also a possible run in 2020. He does talk a little about what's going on there, so be sure to listen into that segment. Then we're going to finish up with Marjorie Dannenfeldzer with Susan B. Anthony List, and we're going to talk about what pro-life legislation and legislators they are working on to try and progress the pro-life cause. Thank you for joining us again on What Matters in North Carolina, and we will move right into Susan Myrick and Hans von Spakovsky right now.
If the court is in session, speaking of the U.S. Supreme Court, there seems to almost always be a North Carolina redistricting case before it.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it's really, boy, what a lot of work, time, and resources folks in North Carolina have spent trying to get redistricting right, and yet their cases almost always seem to end up before the Supreme Court. Even Justice Alito, in one of the cases that just came down concerning two of the congressional districts, said this was like the fifth time that just this one congressional district had ended up before the Supreme Court.
It was originally drawn, I think the one you're talking about, at least the 12th, it was originally drawn back in 1990 by the Democrats, I believe. That's where it started.
Yeah, yeah. But that shows how confused the state of the law is. And in particular, there's really no clear directives to legislatures on what they can and can't do when it comes to redistricting without getting in trouble under the Voting Rights Act and other provisions of the Constitution when it comes to how much you can and should take race into account when you're doing redistricting.
And a part of their recent rulings have been on the congressional maps, which were that was a confusing news report anyway, because they were talking about congressional maps that had already been redrawn in 2016. And we ended up having two primaries, one in March and one in June for the congressional races. We actually voted twice on the congressional races. They just didn't count the votes in March.
Right.
So they used the new maps, but then all of a sudden we get a ruling saying the congressional maps were unconstitutional, which really did confuse a lot of people out there, because they were assuming that it was the maps that
drawn ones, yeah.
But it wasn't at all. So, and now the newest ruling coming down from the court is on our legislative districts.
Right. I mean, it was within, I think, a week or 2 weeks, two cases, two decisions coming from the Supreme Court involving redistricting. And the second decision, and this was the case in which the federal district court, the lower federal district court, had found that something like more than two dozen of the state legislative seats were unacceptable racial gerrymanders. The judge had suddenly said, well, for everybody elected in November 2016, instead of the two-year term to which you would normally be entitled, you're only going to have a one-year term. And the state appealed that to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court issued an order saying, basically sending it back to the lower court and saying, look, that's quite a radical remedy to cut the set term of state legislators. And if you're going to do that, you have to justify that in great detail. There has to be a balancing of the equities, that's the language the court used, between whatever the reasons are for that remedy versus the fact that running their own elections, that's the prerogative of the state government. And the lower court judge, in his original order, had like one sentence justifying it. And the Supreme Court basically unanimously said, that's not enough.
Right.
So they sent it back to the court, and he's going to have to, that judge is going to have to justify in great detail why it is correct to cut the terms from 2 years to 1 year.
I thought it was interesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, that opinion was 3 pages long compared to a one sentence, we're remanding the case back to the state Supreme Court.
Right.
But when it came to, hey, you've made a radical decision here about having new special elections, cutting terms of legislators,
right,
not only this year, but the ones that would be elected in 2017 would only serve for 1 year too.
Right.
So that took 3 pages, but the other one took one sentence. I thought it was very interesting. You mentioned something about, was it Justice Kagan? They got it wrong, and we're going back to the congressional maps. Well, no, this was a congressional legislative map confusion,
right,
where the legislators were talking about districts.
Yeah, in the opinion that came out concerning the two congressional districts, which the majority of the court said were racial gerrymanders,
right,
Justice Alito, in a dissent, pointed out that the lower court in North Carolina had made a basic mistake of fact. He claimed that two of the state legislators, who were the main people behind the redistricting, had said that they were drawing these two congressional districts based on racial reasons to comply with the Voting Rights Act. And therefore, the court concluded, say, it was a racial gerrymander. But that was actually a mistake. The two legislators weren't talking about the congressional districts. They were talking about the state legislative districts.
Right.
And Alito was kind of dumbstruck that the majority opinion in that case, written by Justice Kagan, just completely ignored that mistake of fact.
Another thing, when the U.S. Supreme Court remanded the case to the North Carolina Supreme Court, the North Carolina Supreme Court has actually looked at these maps twice since they were first drawn in 2011 and approved them along with the Obama Justice Department. And I think when you ended up, I think what you said was you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. I know you didn't say that, and we can take that out. But but it really is going to depend on, when it comes to redistricting, what court you appear before.
That's right.
To get an opinion, it can be an approval of districts one time, and then they can be struck down because of race the next time, or because of
it's because look, the law in this area is so murky, and there aren't any clear parameters for legislatures to follow. You know, I call it the Goldilocks principle of redistricting, and what I mean by that is, you know, based on prior cases of the Supreme Court, if you use too much race in redistricting, if it's the predominant factor, well, then the court says you have violated the Constitution. You violated the Equal Protection Clause. And that comes actually out of another North Carolina case called Shaw versus Reno. But if you don't use race at all in redistricting, you're also going to get sued. Because then the claims are going to be, you have violated the Voting Rights Act because you are diluting the voting strength of racial minorities. So state legislatures are put in this position of, well, they can't use too much race. They can't use too little race. They have
just
to use
enough.
They have to use just the right amount. And how you can see it in these North Carolina cases. You had all these different judges, both at the federal level and in the state courts, looking at these maps, and half of them, it seems, came to the conclusion that they were okay. The other half came to the conclusion, well, they were not okay. Well, I guess it depends on how you look at the facts of a particular case and what kind of what is a legislature supposed to do?
Right. So what we need to do from here on out is listen to Justice Clarence Thomas.
That's right.
And take race out of this altogether, finally.
Yes.
60-some years down the road, it's time to do that, I think. I think so, anyway.
Oh, no, I completely agree. You know, Clarence Thomas said that, and he's right. look, if you look at the Constitution, look at our Equal Protection Clause, you look at the 15th and 14th Amendments, it's very clear that you should not be allowed to use race for any reason whatsoever. And race ought to be taken entirely out of the redistricting process. Furthermore, Clarence Thomas said something else, which I think is very important for people to realize, and that is, look, the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 to prevent outright interference with the right to vote. You know, it was to stop the attempts to keep black Americans from being able to register and being able to vote. Okay, well, that doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
It's these cases have been now morphed into the Voting Rights Act being used to prevent so-called dilution of the right to vote. Well, if somebody can easily register and easily vote, well, how are you supposed to judge whether their vote has been, quote-unquote, diluted?
And who makes that? Who is going to
And who's going to make that,
that
decision, right? Right? That is such an amorphous phrase that tells you why. It's like almost every year, there seems to be a redistricting case from North Carolina up before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to just quote one of your sentences here towards the end of this article. This case also bears out another warning given by Alito. The majority's decision threatens to transform federal courts into weapons of political warfare. We're in the middle of that political
yes.
warfare in North Carolina, and I know we're not alone. I know states have already gone through this, but I think most of the people in North Carolina that follow redistricting at all can certainly agree with this sentence.
They should, and in particular, that also once again shows the real problem with the Voting Rights Act today, which is, look, if you gerrymander for partisan political reasons, that's perfectly okay. Doesn't violate
right.
the Constitution,
right.
doesn't violate the Voting Rights Act. If you gerrymander for predominantly racial reasons, that, of course, violates the law. But since African Americans are a monolithic voting bloc for the Democrats, you know, not upwards of 95% of them vote Democratic, well, how are you supposed to distinguish between a partisan motivation and a racial motivation in the redistricting process? It's almost impossible to distinguish the two. So that means you can use the Voting Rights Act to achieve partisan political ends as opposed to doing what it was intended to do, which was to stop actual racial discrimination
right.
in voting.
Right. Thank you so much, Hans.
Susan,
we'll
it's always
have to do this again.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. This is Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and I have George Landreth, the president of Frontiers of Freedom, on the line with us today. So how are you doing, George?
I'm doing great. It's good to be with you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
We appreciate having you. So today we are talking about a recent article you had on Newsmax.com. This was published June 5th, and it is about on-campus recruiting for jobs, for postgraduate jobs. So can you tell us a little about what the heart of this story is?
Sure. Everyone can agree that discrimination is a bad thing, but sometimes we take it to the point of making it silly, and this is that case. There are those that want to shut down on-campus recruiting because they say it discriminates against older people because college students are disproportionately younger people. The problem is it doesn't actually discriminate against older people because if you're an older person in college and you go to the on-campus recruiting, you too can get an interview and you too can be hired. So effectively, I guess what they're really trying to argue is that if you take their idea to its logical extreme, you couldn't even put your ad for a job in any publication that had a distribution of readers that was not completely across the board equal. So, you know, like maybe Rolling Stone, for example, might have a younger readership. Maybe Reader's Digest has an older readership. If you were to advertise for a position in either of those two publications, that would be bad because that's, you know, that's their argument, basically.
Right.
So you have a group of people who are, after 8 years of an anemic economy during the Obama administration, high unemployment rates in that group, people who've got lots of debt they've built up thanks to, again, Obama making student loans freely available. So what happened is all your, you know, tuitions went up, and they're unemployed, and they get to live in their parents' basement. And then when they try to get a job at a job fair on campus, they're told that they're engaging in some sort of terrible discrimination. To me, that's about as crazy as it gets.
Right, and sort of my illogical, logical conclusion I came to was if some people have, you know, younger people tend to use the internet maybe at a higher rate than older people, you can't advertise a job online anymore.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Same exact argument, because if you look statistically speaking, the older people, you know, let's say 60 and up, do not use the internet. They're not as connected as people who are, you know, 30 and under, who are the most connected. And so then all of a sudden all these online job apps and sites are, you know, oh my gosh, that's all discrimination. It's age discrimination. So, you know, I understand what age discrimination is. Age discrimination is saying we won't hire you because you're too old, or we won't hire you because we wanted somebody older than you, even though you meet our qualifications. That's age discrimination. They want to stretch it to the point where going on campus to interview a couple hundred students, some of whom may be older and some of whom may be younger, is discrimination simply because, generally speaking, colleges are populated with you know, folks under 30, you know, predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly.
Right.
And so they're effectively going to shut down and make it so nobody can get a job. If they get their way on this, like you said, then it's going to, the next step is online jobs are not right. And it's crazy stuff, and it's just taking things to its illogical, nutty extreme, to the point of it becoming just beyond the pale stupid and really counterproductive. It's not going to be useful to have the upcoming generation finding it more and more difficult to find jobs, particularly, you know, it's liberalism that made their tuition cost more, and it's liberalism that's going to keep them unemployed. I mean, you know, if nothing else, this ought to convince millennials that liberalism's not been good to them.
Right, and so I guess
they might want to try a freedom and opportunity agenda instead.
Right, and I guess maybe a fix for this would be for every on-campus job fair, there could be a job fair at a retirement community.
Yeah.
Would that even things out?
Yeah, not that a lot of people in the job community. You know, that's the funny thing is employers like this because it allows them to interview a large number of qualified applicants for their entry-level positions where they have certain skill sets or certain degrees that are kind of prerequisites for doing it. And students like it because they don't have a lot of money to go traveling all over the country and interview with all these companies. But since they come on campus, it's as easy as pie because they just go to school, you know, wear a little better clothes that day, do their interview, and, you know, they make a lot of contacts. So it's a win-win, and quite frankly, this sort of leftist nuttiness wants to turn it into a lose-lose. Employers will have a harder time, have to spend more resources, money to find applicants, because they'll be told, you know, you can't do it online, you can't do it, you know, they'll have to buy smoke signals or something like that. I don't know, but so maybe smoke signals don't discriminate.
It just seems...
You know, we can all see the sky or something. I don't know. Then it would discriminate against people in New York because the buildings would block their view. But, you know, this is what we're getting down to, is this level of kind of just nuttiness. We're no longer worried about whether people are actually discriminating. We're just playing these stupid math games that get in the way of people finding jobs, that get in the way of employers finding people to do work, both need that. If you want to see the economy grow, you want employers to be able to find the employees they need, and you want people who need jobs to find them. That's not really rocket science, you know. That's when the economy is bad, it's usually because unemployment is high. And so I don't know why they have this desire to make it harder for people to find employment, but that seems to be the name of the game. And interestingly enough, the older crowd doesn't have a big problem with unemployment. many of them aren't employed because they're retired and they don't want to be employed. And the ones that want to be employed tend to be because they've, you know, they landed their dream job a while ago and they're still doing it. It's the younger crowd that needs to find that dream job. And so this is, I mean, I have rarely seen something that is as nutty as this. I remember asking an attorney who was dealing with this matter. I said, so what's, when you've dealt with the other side and they're making their argument for this, what do they say? And he said, they say that school, you know, and I was like, really? That's the best they can come up with. And he was, yeah, it's nutty, but they're finding traction with certain people in the bureaucracies of government who think, hey, this sounds a good idea. This will keep us busy. We'll have a lot more to do now. We can start banning people from on-campus recruiting. And again, it seems like they're in search of a problem because I don't see one here, but they're going to find one even if there isn't one.
Right. It seems hard to kind of point out which party is harmed. I mean, you're saying it's, or not you, but the people who are pushing this are saying that it's the older people. It's, but there's no rule that says that older people can't go to school. People do go to school and return to school often after this, the usual age, I guess, of the 18 to 22 to 24 kind of range. People are, plenty of people are in school. I remember from my classes a few years ago, there were people outside of that age range in those classes.
Now, and just to make this clear, if they show up, if an older person shows up to go to an interview and the interviewer says, oh, we're not interested in you. You're way too old for this job. We don't want you. That is age discrimination. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about just whether or not you can have on-campus interviews at all. And conducting them completely fairly and completely dispassionately and completely, you know, equally. They want to say they're unequal nonetheless. And so, you know, to me, I scratch my head and ask myself, what are you trying to fix here? It seems to me they're trying to fix employment, make sure that nobody has a job so there's more people are dependent upon them.
It seems like an idle time in search of a problem for me. I mean, it's kind of related in my mind as well to don't go where all the fish are if you want to go fishing because all the fish are there, or most of the fish, because not every fish is there.
If you're an employer, you know, this, you've got this large group of people who don't have a job because they're students. They're about ready to being done being students because they're graduating and they're looking for work. This is like a match made in heaven. You know, if your employer has a lot of jobs, you want to be there to, like you said, fish where all the fish are.
Right. They've got jobs to hand out. Graduates need jobs. Who's hurt? Who's hurt? I mean, it is a mutually beneficial relationship. Everyone gets to use their time efficiently. The student gets to use their time efficiently because they are just walking from between my 2 o'clock class and my 4 o'clock class. Let me go interview for a job that could benefit me after school. And the recruit, the job, you know, recruiters with the jobs are sitting there saying, here's my whole list of very good qualified applicants. It just seems like it's beneficial for everyone involved.
Well, one of the weird things about it too is when if this idea gets full traction, the next thing they're going to start arguing is that when you have requirements of a certain number of years experience for a job, that's age discrimination too, because experience on some level equates to age. And so if they want you to have 7 years experience in the field, that probably means they don't want you to have graduated last year. They want you to have graduated 7 years ago at least and to have been employed in the interim. So then you could argue, okay, so now they're discriminating on the basis of age, even though the job may require that level of experience. And so this is the danger of government essentially trying to micromanage everything we do, is it just gets nutty. And like I said, I think most people can agree, discrimination, not cool, not good. Our law prohibits that anyhow. But this is a point where this isn't really discrimination. This is just simply, like you said, you're going fishing where the fish are. Or in the example I gave, you may have a job that requires a certain amount of experience in order for you to do the job well and be successful. And there'll be some enterprising trial attorney who's going to argue that requiring experience prohibits certain people from getting a job. Well, yeah. So does having an education. Like if you say, you know, I mean, you know, any requirement you put in for the position could theoretically knock certain people out of being considered for the job. And if that becomes discrimination, then basically they're arguing that wanting to have a well-trained employee that meets your criteria for what you're doing, like let's say you're, you know, a doctor in a doctor's office, and you want to have somebody who can read X-rays. And my position is I can look in the X-ray just like he can. My eyes are good too. And you want experience, you want training. I mean, you know, my eyes are as good as his. And they're like, but there's more than that, Mr. Landreth. And I'm like, sounds like discrimination to me. That's just what I just, to me, this is the, we're getting way out far afield from the idea that people should treat each other fairly. We're now to the point where, like you said, we're going to ban people from doing internet advertising because some group of people use the internet more than others.
Right, and at minimum, it seems like it'll just completely bog down the application process if you can't put any of these different tiers, these different, you know, gates saying, okay, I'm not a doctor, I'm a journalist and sometimes radio host, so I think I'm going to apply for that job over at Wake Med, at the local hospital here. And
right.
My application's not going to go anywhere, but do they have to give it some sort of consideration because of these changes in definition of what discrimination is?
That's what worries me, is that that's the way we're headed. Right now, they're just dealing with the age issue. But if they're successful on the age issue, they can turn lots of things into age. Years of experience could be, you know, you could say, well, I would have years of experience as a medical technician. I just haven't done it yet. And so in 7 years from now, I'll have that experience, but you're discriminating against me because I'm not 7 years older. And it's just, someone could say, oh, they would never do that. And I would say, well, excuse me, 10 years ago, if I had told you someone was going to say on-campus recruiting is age discrimination, you would have told me that will never happen. And that argument is now being made, and it's getting traction at the EEOC. So I think we have to recognize that the truly insane can, in fact, come about and become real, and it's not useful to tell ourselves, oh, don't worry, that will never happen. The answer is it will eventually, because that's what liberals do.
That's definitely a good point there, that never say never, and especially it's being proven time and time again now. So tell us a little about what you do at Frontiers of Freedom.
Sure. Frontiers of Freedom is a think tank. It was founded by Malcolm Wallop. He was a U.S. senator from Wyoming, a friend and ally of Ronald Reagan's. And so when he retired from the Senate after 3 terms or 18 years, he, you know, he said, I'm tired of, you know, in the Senate, but I'm not tired of trying to make America a better place and make sure we have more individual liberty and freedom. And so he started a think tank, and that was Frontiers of Freedom, and he asked me to head it up, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today on What Matters in North Carolina. We look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
I would enjoy it very much.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Poulter uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. I'm Matt Calder, sitting across the desk from Governor Pat McCrory, and we're happy to have you here today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Nice turnout. Great, great convention.
Oh, yeah. So the governor just came off stage speaking at the Civitas Leadership Conference, the Conservative Leadership Conference. And first, how does it kind of coming back here this year versus last year?
Well, I'd rather be governor at this point in time, but there's some lessons learned and some work we're very proud of, because it turns out there was a Carolina economic comeback in North Carolina, and I think it's partly because of the policy that we initiated during the past 4 years, and now we're just reading about it in the media. So I'm proud that we left state government in good financial shape. They're now fighting over what to do with the surplus, whether to give it back to the people of North Carolina, invest it in other things. And when I came into office, we were not having this debate. We were having the debate of how do we deal with a deficit and how do we deal with inefficient government. And I'm very proud of the work that we did in the past 4 years, and I had a chance to talk about it today.
So in that vein, are you concerned about with Governor Cooper coming in, you know, a Democrat following in your time as governor? Are you concerned about that being walked back in some ways?
Absolutely. I'm very concerned that Governor Cooper may try to dismantle a lot of the innovative, conservative initiatives that we implemented during the past 4 years, whether it be transportation reform, tax reform, Medicaid reform, and the media is going to give him a free ride in doing that, unlike that we got. But there's great concern that we'll start politicizing road building again like the old days, the good old boy system of building roads. There's concern that we'll spend all the money of the surplus and not have reserves. There's concern that we're not having the follow-through on Hurricane Matthew to help the people that we need to help now more than ever. I have concern that the corruption will come back in North Carolina government, which we didn't have during my 4 years. I'm very, very concerned for the ninth largest state in the United States of America.
Right, and you mentioned Hurricane Matthew, and so even before the election, there was criticism from then candidate Cooper on how much the state was saving back for a rainy day fund, when your point was that money was needed for emergencies. And it seemed to be kind of proven.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. We fought for a rainy day fund, and Cooper said we're putting too much money in the rainy day fund during the campaign. And it turns out it rained. It rained, it rained, it rained. And 28 lives were taken. A lot of neighborhoods and towns were totally destroyed. And thank God we fought for the rainy day fund as opposed to doling out the money for votes, which is what past governors did. And now we're having to spend some of that money, but we're still in good financial shape because our rainy day fund was at the largest it had ever been in state history. So I'm very, very proud of that.
So in a way, do you feel like you put in work, you put in time, you build a really nice house and someone else is living in it now?
Well, I don't, that's a great way to put it. I miss the job. I miss the team. I miss the accomplishments. But more than anything, I'm concerned they're going to disband and the progress that we made in a short four years in reforming state government in North Carolina. Listen, I was an outsider coming into Raleigh here. I was always considered outsider, even by some of my conservative brethren. And being an outsider, I had to step on the status quo of the good old boy system in North Carolina. And I'm afraid we're going back to that good old boy system in North Carolina, which I'm not talking about good old boy regarding nice people. I'm talking about good old boy regarding deals, and deals are not efficient for the taxpayers of North Carolina.
Right, and you mentioned your accomplishments. So what is your, I guess, your proudest accomplishment from your time as governor?
I think two or three. One is the tax reform that we initiated. We had one of the highest income taxes in the Southeast, the highest income tax in the Southeast. We weren't competitive for jobs. And we lowered the income tax. Now we're below our neighbors. We're one of the lowest in the Southeast. We're not lower than Florida, of course, which is zero. But we really revised the whole tax system, which the newspaper said there's no way Governor McCrory is ever going to get this done. And by the way, they very rarely bring it up either. And the second is transportation reform. We took the politics out of road building. And we, as a result of that, conservatives got a bigger bang for their buck. We just quit naming roads after politicians in order to get that done.
Oh, yeah. And that really seemed so, the especially, you know, the DOT reforms and the way roads are built, that's a very non-public, in the public eye thing to do. So
that's because the backroom deals for roads in the past 50 years in North Carolina were not known either. It was almost like patronage, political payoffs. And I took that out of the system. And I'm just praying that the current legislature or governor doesn't try to bring that system back and start making deals on roads, which is good for the person who maybe lives near the powerful politician, but it's not good for the state of North Carolina or all the taxpayers of North Carolina, because that brings about very inefficient. And I also don't want corruption.
All right. And so what have you been up to in the past few months?
Well, I'm spending more time with my wife. I'm getting a little recreation time. I'm serving on a couple of boards, helping with the foundation, trying to encourage entrepreneurship in North Carolina. One of the great weaknesses of North Carolina is young people trying to find capital to start a business who are graduating from our community colleges or universities. We are not capital intensive in helping especially young people or older people who have a brilliant idea and aren't getting support from the banks and other financial institutions, but need some startup money. So I'm very, very interested in helping the small entrepreneur. Those are the people I respect more than anyone else. Those are the people who work in manufacturing plants in North Carolina.
Okay. So then also in the session, you talked about staying involved in one way or another. Can you be a little more specific on that?
Yeah, I'm going to keep stating my opinions. I love this state so much. I'm going to call people out when I don't think they're doing a good job, whether it be the governor or whether it be the legislature. And then I'm going to go through a consideration whether to get back involved in politics and run for governor again. And I'm going to keep that door open for the future. But campaigns start way too early. And I think people make these decisions way too early. We have no idea what the political environment will be 2 years from now. But I'm going to keep the option open. I don't miss being governor. I miss the job of governor. And I didn't become governor to live in a big house on Blunt Street or to get a road named after me. I wanted to be governor to make a difference, and we did just that. And by doing that, we may have lost the election because we stepped on a lot of toes, even though we lost the close election in North Carolina history by a thumbnail. And I'm going to keep that door open, and no matter what, I'm going to stay involved in this state.
All right, and so it seems like the Republican candidate, in a lot of ways, waiting in the wings before you lost to Cooper, would have been Dan Forrest.
Mm-hmm.
Do you foresee a maybe in 2020 a head-to-head primary?
I have no idea. I've never worried about primaries. Again, that won't be part of my faction. Nothing against Dan, or it might be a state senator, a member of the state house. When I ran for governor in 08, we had six people running, and – and by the way, they're all friends of mine. And so this is not personal. It's what's best for the state. And in 2 years, I'll make a decision whether I'd be the best candidate or not and best person to be governor of North Carolina. And that's what I'll be going through that. And whether I want to do it again or not and put my family through a very, very difficult process.
All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. This is Matt Calder with the Freedom Action Network, and I'm across the table from Marjorie Dannenfelser.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
With the Susan B. Anthony list, and she's just gotten off the stage for her segment at the Civitas Conservative Leadership Conference. And how did things go for you there?
Oh, it was great. You know, Ann McElhaney always, if she speaks before me, she always makes me cry. So that was good. After I cleaned up my mascara, we got to work on pro-life strategy and winning elections. And so that was the core of what I was talking about.
Right. And that's definitely a good pairing to go together. Because, I mean, so we're here, you know, it's a state-based show. Mm-hmm. Susan B. Anthony List, of course, coming out of D.C., can you talk a little about what your organization does?
Sure. We are the national organization that really focuses on the strategy for winning national elections and U.S. Senate seats and House seats, so very federally oriented. And the principle behind beginning with elections, which we do, is that it's vital to begin with elections, which they must lead to legislation, which then leads to the next election, which then leads to next legislation. It must be integrated. Otherwise, once you've lobbied on the pro-life issue, once you've the pro-life movement, as has happened in North Carolina and Susan B. Anthony List's efforts, elects a candidate, if you don't connect it with a strong legislative strategy, it kind of gets forgotten, and it's very easy to forget. So a good message, a good voter turnout strategy, a good legislative agenda, and enough money to power that whole machine is vital for the pro-life issue to win.
Right. So really, Susan B. Anthony List is looking for the front to back, everything all-inclusive from start to finish process of getting pro-life legislation going, from pro-life legislators to doing the work and getting the T's crossed and I's dotted.
That's right. And I think, I mean, North Carolina is a perfect example. I mean, I have a bias toward it because I'm from Greenville. But also, it's been a very important state for the whole nation for quite some time. So in 2014 and in 2016, we had canvassers going across the state from coast to mountains visiting homes of our likely voters. Whether they are Hispanics, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, many of the voters that we reach are not generally targets of the Republican Party, and our goal is to motivate them to vote on Election Day. So when we've done that with Senator Tillis and Senator Burr, they were our friends before, certainly, but without question, we are very, very strong allies in Washington now. Senator Tillis and I are on a texting friendship basis, and I don't say that to say, oh, how great am I? I say that so that it's well communicated that this is a very important partnership where he is very close to the strategy of the pro-life movement.
Right, and so why is this issue so important now, or is it growing in importance still? I mean, where is all that at?
No doubt it is growing in importance. And the purpose of the strategy that I just described was to strengthen the muscle and the arm of the pro-life movement so that not only taking that position would be the right thing to do, but it'd be the smart political thing to do. And it has become more and more apparent to Democrats and independents, mainly Democrats that are in office, that their litmus test on this issue is hurting them at the polls. This is what Nancy Pelosi was very direct in saying very recently, that there should be no Democratic litmus test on the abortion issue, that the reason that Trump won was because of evangelical, Catholic, and pro-life voters, and that the Democratic Party has some work to do on this issue. This is not how they were talking just a year ago. We are very strong now as a movement, and it's important because it's the central human rights battle of our time.
And are you seeing more of a resurgence in younger generations of pro-life idea? It seemed like there was the advent of the 60s and 70s kids that were very pro-choice, my body, my choice, all of this. And then are you seeing that shifting now in the younger generations?
Yes, it's very astute that it is exactly the case. And there are a couple of factors involved. Experience is one. Sonograms. Young people who saw their siblings' sonograms on the refrigerator. It's a little bit hard to ignore that you're looking at your brother, not just a mass of cells, or your sister, and to feel protective. People have grown up seeing that now. And so the young people of today see this, not all, of course, but increasing numbers see this as their civil rights moment, as their political activism. I'm going to live for something worthwhile, and saving the life of another person is a pretty darn good reason to get engaged and involved. Not only is that anecdotal evidence available wherever you look, especially at the March for Life, but you can definitely see it even in our own targeting of who our best voters are in Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, battleground states. They tend to be younger. They tend to be female over men, and generally and Hispanics. Those are our best voters in these battleground states. That says a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And I think mentioning the advancement of technology for sonograms is a big part of it. I have a daughter who's under two, so I very well still remember being in there in the room, and we get these little images. She looks like a little peanut waving at me. And yeah. This is, before 12 weeks or so. I mean, this is very, very early in the pregnancy.
Yeah.
So we know more now about the process from conception to birth than I think past generations. And even so the information's out there. And that's one thing you talked about. But it seems that there's just this realizing of this was a bundle of cells,
right,
that people know it's not true. They know they've been fooled, or past generations have been fooled.
That's
and there's a rebellion against that, I would think.
It is definitely happening. I mean, we were all a zygote once, that's a great t-shirt. Maybe we'll make one day. We all started like that. The idea that either of us were just a clump of cells, you might call us that. You might call us really, really young, the youngest that you could be. That realization, and I, the way you describe the experience is so perfect and so vital and so central to this success. that I don't know that we would have gotten there without science. But isn't that great that one of the core reasons that we are where we are is because of the development of science and understanding? Because out of sight, out of mind has undermined many human rights movements. But this one in particular is vulnerable to that because the baby is out of sight and it's very easy to be out of mind unless you're tracking that sonogram. So that's why people are for ultrasound bills. That's for why the pro-life movement, it's important to describe at 20 weeks, which is sort of the federal level, probably next step. It's our top legislative priority, that at 20 weeks, that's when mothers are told by their doctors to start singing to their child, that he or she can hear, that they resonate to her voice already, that they have eyebrows, that their vision is becoming a little bit more acute. It's amazing that what you know affects your behavior, and that's a good thing.
And right, and I think about 20 weeks. We're halfway through pregnancy. Mm-hmm. We had a one of those really cool 4D,
oh wow,
smoothed out images. So I mean, I saw my daughter's face at that time.
It gives you chills, doesn't it?
It does when I think about in contrast to somebody could walk in, and they could end that life.
Yeah,
and I also think about in another way what's become kind of more popular is when as part of the grieving process for a miscarriage, people will hold funerals for their miscarried child.
That's right.
So how can we on the one side say, this isn't a person, you can have an abortion, and then at the other side say, you can have a funeral for your miscarried child?
That's exactly that is the core question. It's all in the mind of the want of the person who wants or doesn't want. And I think more and more, though, because of what you just described, even if I don't want, I realize I'm dealing not with an appendicitis, an appendix that has to be removed, but a human being with equal dignity and equal rights with me. And that is the struggle. That is the core of the human rights struggle that you just described. And that's been the core of every other successful human rights movement since the beginning of the founding. Child labor laws, abolition, voting rights for different populations. It's always been about the dignity of the human being, and when we realize it, when we look at it, when we're forced to look at it, America responds well. And I really think that when we get this right, many other things will follow. I always learned that, you know, you get one virtue, you try to practice it and do really well, and you kind of start to perfect that a little, then a lot of other ones follow. I think nothing more true for the pro-life movement leading the nation into embracing liberty in other places.
All right. Well, thank you. That wraps it up. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Thank you again to Marjorie Dannenfelser with Susan B. Anthony List for sitting down to talk with us about her organization. Thank you also to Governor Pat McCrory for taking the time to tell us about what he's been up to since leaving the governor's mansion and about possible future plans. Thank you again to George Landreth for sitting down with us on the phone and talking to us about Frontiers of Freedom. And also thank you to Susan Myrick and Hans von Spakovsky for doing that interview all about our election system in North Carolina and all the many challenges in the courts going on with that. If you want more of this content, go to www.freedomactionnetwork.com, where you can check out this show, past shows, individual segments of these shows, and also the other shows we have on the radio station. That is NC Gun Dad, hosted by me, and also the Free to Brew show hosted by Greg Polcher, which is all about craft brewing. If you want to follow along with us online, you can do that on social media, on Facebook and on Twitter, at WhatMattersNC. Again, that is at WhatMattersNC. Or also, like I said, if you want to check us out and check out all these shows, you can do it over either iTunes or on the website. So iTunes, What Matters in North Carolina, or on the website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Thank you, and we will join you again next week.